This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 208 was recorded on February 27th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Fasanara Capital founder Francesco Filia is back as this week's feature interview guest. As per normal, Francesco supplied us with another terrific slide deck. We'll be looking at the reasons why Francesco thinks markets are particularly susceptible to a sudden shock, flash crash type of event. And for the record, folks, this interview was taped before the market tanked on coronavirus-related news. We've had terrific feedback on last week's post-game segment when Patrick explained how to put on some basic long vol trades. So this week, Patrick will take it to the next level, with a focus on tail hedges and how to put them on using options.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, before we even get to equities here, let's start with a quick update on the COVID-19 coronavirus story. But listeners, we already did a full 90-minute podcast on the COVID-19 situation on Monday this week. So you can find that link on the homepage of Macro Voices. But Eric, you promised last week that if we did a separate podcast on this virus update, that you'd keep your comments in this week's market wrap to less than 15 minutes. So I'm starting my stopwatch right now.
Oh boy, the pressure is on. A lot's happened since Monday, dude. Actually, I'm exaggerating. Really, not that much has happened all week, quite frankly. There have been zero surprises and not a whole lot of new news. All we've had is confirmations of things that we have all known were certain to happen since late January when we first told you what to expect. So if you were surprised this week by the market sell-off, you weren't paying attention to Macro Voices in recent weeks. Needless to say, though, this was the week that the market woke up to what has, frankly, should have been obvious since the end of January. And again, for anyone who missed it, we told you exactly what was coming and what to expect in our January 30th episode. That was the week when it became clear that there's going to be a global pandemic. So we dropped everything. We asked Julian Brigden to share the spotlight with Dr. Chris Martinson, and we did a second feature interview about the coronavirus pandemic, which they're still not calling a pandemic, but that's what it is. So there can be no doubt about that. Now, for anyone who's thinking, oh, well, how can you say that? Nobody could have known back then that this was going to happen. I anticipated that people would say exactly that. So on February 8th, I penned a Twitter thread titled, "When Was It Clear?" documenting why it was clear by February 1st that a global pandemic was coming. So the easy part is over. It was easy to see that we're going to have a global pandemic. And there's probably one more easy part of this, which hasn't really hit the tape yet in terms of market reaction, and that is that the United States is going to be included in that pandemic. It seems like markets and Americans are still living in this fantasy that maybe somehow, you know, there hasn't been any evidence really of community spreading inside the United States, so maybe it's just going to happen overseas. Look, the reason there's no evidence of community spreading in the United States is because no testing is being done in the United States. Less than 500 total tests conducted to date by the CDC. So that's the part that we know is coming that means there's going to be at least a little bit more market downside. But the hard part is really gauging, okay, what kind of pandemic? What is this pandemic going to involve? And what are the economic consequences going to be? Now, to be sure, the worst case scenario is worse than the 2008 financial crisis in terms of its economic outcome. But it is absolutely not the case that we know that's going to happen. We don't have enough information yet. So the key issue here to understand, and it's one we don't understand because it's unknown yet, is how this is going to play out specifically. We know that there's going to be more breakouts of this virus all around the world because the virus has already spread all around the world. Are they going to be like Singapore and Hong Kong, where there's a breakout and there's a lot of attention paid to it and you have several hundred cases, but then they get it under control and that those cases kind of stop growing? They're still growing a little bit in Singapore and Hong Kong, but the exponential growth rate that we were seeing in the early days of Singapore looked just as bad as Wuhan, China. They got it under control. It's growing, but it's growing very slowly now, and it looks like it's coming completely under control. On the other hand, Daegu, South Korea, Northern Italy, and Iran are all out of control. They are looking very much like they could all turn into the next three Wuhan Chinas. So are we going to have more Wuhan type of events, or are we going to have more Singapore type of events? For sure, there's going to be a few hundred cases in lots of different places around the world. But is it going to turn into thousands of cases and hundreds of deaths, as happened in Wuhan and appears to already be happening in Korea and probably also in Italy and Iran right now? Or are they going to be under control? We're not really sure of the answer to that yet. And frankly, we don't know exactly why Singapore and Hong Kong are coming under control and why Korea and Italy and Iran are not coming under control. I can speculate, having spent plenty of time in Singapore and having lived in Hong Kong, Singapore has a very authoritarian culture. When the government tells people to do things, people obey because they're afraid of the consequence. Hong Kong was terrorized by the SARS event in 2003, and people are taking this very seriously. So I know in those two places, the response has been very serious, very focused, trying to do everything possible to contain the outbreak. Something's gone very badly wrong in Korea, Italy, and Iran. So what is going to happen to the rest of the world? Well, it's really going to be hard to tell because now everybody's lying. Certainly, there's been more evidence out of China that the government is just plain lying. Documents have now been discovered and revealed by Epoch Times, which is one of the newspapers that's been covering this. I personally am very suspect the case count in Japan has started to taper off. It's not growing nearly as quickly. When did that exponential case count growth trajectory suddenly start to calm down a little bit? Right about the same time that Dr. Kentaro Itawa, I think, I can't remember the gentleman's name, basically exposed gross incompetence on the part of the Japanese government in managing the situation. I think they're starting to lie about their case count, too. That's just my own speculation. So we don't really know, and we don't have solid data because a lot of governments are motivated to lie. The case count in Thailand has completely leveled off at 35 cases, hasn't grown by a single case in well over a week. I don't believe the numbers. They're very, very financially dependent on tourism, and they don't want to shut it down. Now, Patrick, there's one really, really big black swan that may be on the horizon here. This has to do with the second infection and instant collapse and death that we're seeing. There have been several cases, you've seen the videos of this, where somebody's just walking down the street, going about their business, and all of a sudden, wham, they just pass out, fall over, and die on the spot. There's been videos like that out of China, and people are like, what the heck? Is that for real? Is that really happening? Now we're seeing the same thing in Korea. Exactly what's going on, how much of this is occurring, how many cases like this there really have been, we don't have really solid data on. But there's a theory, which is the first time you get infected with this thing, it could be just a bad flu. You get a little bit sick, you feel some flu symptoms, and you get better. Then, when you get the infection of the same virus the second time, normally what happens is your body would have built up some immunity to that virus, and you wouldn't be as vulnerable. There's something called a cytokine storm. It's way beyond my pay grade medical stuff. If you want to know more about it, watch Dr. Chris Martinson's videos and the Peak Prosperity YouTube channel, and he goes into great detail and explains how it works. Basically, when your immune system should be fighting this thing, your immune system malfunctions, and what kills you is your own immune system. We don't know this for sure yet, but it looks like on the second infection by the same COVID-19 virus or SARS-CoV-2 virus, which causes COVID-19, it may be that second infection which can lead to these instantaneous fatalities. Is that going to be a big thing that's going to affect a whole bunch of people? Or is that just some extremely rare event that's only happened a few times and it was so crazy that it just got a lot of attention on YouTube? We don't know that yet, but that would be the black swan that really, really makes this thing an extreme economic event if everybody is afraid of literally just getting it a second time and suddenly dying on the spot. There's another aspect of this which very few people are talking about, which is this is not a one-time thing, Patrick. It's not like, okay, this is going to be really bad, but we're going to get through it like we got through SARS, and then it's going to be forgotten, and it's, you know, it's all done with. This will be with us forever. Every flu season, there will be another return of the COVID virus. Now, hopefully, by season two, we've got a chance of maybe having a vaccine. Having any kind of vaccine here in season one is pretty much out of the question, despite some of the contrary news reports that you see. So we can talk about the implications for each asset class, but that's the quick update.
Eric, let's talk to equity markets. Last week, when we were recording this on an intraday high, we almost traded at 3,400 on the S&P. Here we are just 1 week later, and we wiped out almost 400 S&P points in one fluid motion. Now that is the market suddenly starting to care.
Well, Patrick, as you say, it was a really big move, and it's one that our listeners probably should have anticipated because we told you this was coming. I'll be perfectly honest with you, Patrick. I missed the equity move. I shouldn't say I missed it. I intentionally opted out of it. Initially, when I saw what was coming back at the end of January, I bought a whole bunch of puts on E-mini S&P futures. And at the time, I was just convinced that the market had to have this exact event that it had this week. I thought it was coming 2 or 3 weeks ago. And when the market just kept melting up the other way, I said, okay, look, these puts are losing value. I'm going to close that position and redeploy it with puts on crude oil futures. And I suppose in some ways, Patrick, I could have done a little better because the equity market move has been a little bit more brisk than the crude oil move, although after today, I'm not sure if that's even true. And maybe that would have played better. But the thing is, when I would have put the puts on, the market was hadn't made it all the way up to 3,400 yet. It was still at 3,200. So, you know, I'm kicking myself. When I took that trade off, what I should have done is I should have said, wait a minute, I need to be using the calendared straddle strategy, which I know you have been working with your members at Big Picture Trading on. In the heat of the moment, I just took the trade off and I redeployed it in crude oil. I don't have any regrets because I did extremely well with those puts on crude oil futures. But I want to follow up. I'm assuming you guys at Big Picture Trading must have caught this top using the calendared straddle trade. How did that work out for your members?
Oh, absolutely. I'm just so happy for my members. So many people came on board to the membership to try to catch this market top. And we were straddled up at the 340 SPYs, and my members cashed in really big on this drop. So it was really exciting, and congratulations to all of them.
Well, Patrick, I want to congratulate your members, too, and I want to congratulate you for having exactly the right strategy. And I'm kicking myself. I've heard you explain this strategy and why it's a better approach than just a straight short or a straight put on the equity market. I went and I put on the straight put. I had exactly the problem that you developed this strategy to overcome. And when I had it, instead of switching to your strategy, which would have worked better, I ended up giving up on the equity market and went back to crude oil because that's what I know best. Fortunately for me, it worked out. The crude oil trade ended up paying off pretty darn well.
All right, Eric, but I guess now we can say that the easy part is over. So the real question now is what's next? I mean, it would be very natural for the market to get a bounce at some point, but is this going to turn into something much bigger and more ominous, or is this just a little quick correction? What's your take on all of this?
Well, I definitely agree with you that from here it gets much harder. First of all, I think there's pretty much guaranteed to be more downside to the market because the market is not discounting a breakout in the United States. And there seems to be this idea, you know, rah, 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 USA number one, we're somehow immune to a virus that affects all human beings equally. That whole, you know, Asian people are more susceptible concept has pretty much been ruled out now by the scientists. Somehow we're we're American, so it's not going to happen to us. The only reason it's not happening to us is because we're not testing for it, so we don't realize that it's already happening to us. When that reality hits the tape, there's definitely another wave of equity selling behind that. But after that, it gets really, really complicated because you know there's going to be policy announcements. You know the Fed is going to announce that they're, you know, there to help. Janet Yellen voluntarily kind of came out of retirement to volunteer the information that she thinks in the next downturn, the Fed ought to buy equities. So, you know, as much as this should be a really big down event for markets, if you got the guys with the keys to the printing press buying stocks, almost anything is possible. The other problem is we don't know how big the downside is. One thing is for sure, which is we're going to continue to have these breakouts of the virus and cases and deaths all around the world. Nobody's immune. The places, even South America, where there were no cases, now there's one. I'm convinced there's thousands of cases in South America. They just haven't been testing for them, so we don't know that they're there yet. The asymptomatic transmission and long incubation period means that people don't develop symptoms for a while. So it's starting to happen. It's going to continue. It's going to accelerate. Iran and Italy and South Korea are not the only ones. There's going to be lots more of those. But the question is it going to go the way of Singapore and Hong Kong, where we learn how to get these things under control, and after a few hundred cases, we can stop an outbreak? Or do they go completely wild the way Wuhan, China did, and the way it's starting to look like maybe Italy and Iran and South Korea could go, although the jury's still out on those right now? We don't know that. We don't know if this sudden instant death syndrome on the second reinfection of the virus is even a real thing. It may be that speculation people have as to what's going on based on watching a few YouTube videos that might have been faked for all we know. Or it could be that that's a feature of this virus. These cytokine storms could be the really, really big killer that is going to make this much worse than anybody imagined. We don't know any of those things yet. It's still too early in the story. So the magnitude of how big the downside could be and how it gets punctuated as those different legs down happen by various policy measures that could result in some vicious rallies, it's very, very hard to know how to play this. I tend to think, and part of this is just from my personal background of not really being an equity trader, being more of a commodities guy, I don't want to try to speculate in the equity market myself on what's going to happen here. I think it's much easier to anticipate what's going to happen in the bond market and in the commodity markets. Certainly, there's going to be a huge amount of volatility and action and price movement in equity markets. I just think it's going to be kind of hard to figure out what happens in what order. And if you get wrong-footed, the moves are going to be big and vicious in both directions.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index here, because we had a great rally on the U.S. dollar, but really during this entire market pullback, the dollar's been giving most of its gains back. I mean, we were almost at the 100 handle, and right now we're trading just below 99. What's your take on all of this?
You know, if I look at where the channel was before we broke out of the channel, we've broken back down into the channel and down to the bottom of the channel, but we didn't take out that lower channel support line. And until we do, it looks to me like this correction, which was overdue, I think we called for this correction, if I remember correctly, a couple weeks ago on Macro Voice, just saying, hey, I think it's going much higher, but boy, look at how many up days in a row we've had. We're overdue for some kind of pullback. We got our pullback. Looks to me like we're poised to move much higher from here. Now, if we see a breakdown below 98 spot 50 or so on a daily closing basis, or even a little lower than that, I'm visually drawing the line here in my head without actually charting it on the page as we're speaking. Then if you get below those lows, and the way you would draw it, if anybody wants to, is to look at the 1231 and the 131, so the December 31 and the January 31 bottoms on the dollar index, draw a line through those. When you close below that line, then I start to get worried. Above that line where we still are, I think it's a pullback that was warranted, that's overdue, and I think that flight capital into the U.S. dollar is going to likely propel us higher. Dollar and gold both moving up in reaction to the global response to the coronavirus.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because there was an extraordinary drop at the same time as the stock market dropping. I mean, we were trading close to $55 last week, where you were looking for it to fade it. We've dropped over 15%, and we're trading right around that 47 handle now. What's your thinking here on crude?
Well, my 50-strike puts on WTI crude have appreciated in value since I bought them for 60 cents. But I'm sticking to my story in terms of the big picture, and I mean that from 2 weeks ago. What I said then is, at the time, WTI was trading at $52. I said, I think fair value is $10 lower at $42, but I expect it to go up $5 first and then down 15. We didn't get the whole up 5. We got about 4.5. And we're on the way toward the down 15. Now, the real number, I said 42 kind of off the top of my head. It's actually 42.36. That's the low from December of 2018. And that's an initial target. I think that based on what we already know about the certainties of what's going to happen, we know there's going to be more outbreaks of this virus around the world. We know that Korea and Italy and Iran are not the only ones. We know there's more coming. And we know that it's going to happen in the United States, even though President Trump said it was unlikely. I think it's a near certainty that there will be both community spreading and outbreaks in the continental United States and everywhere else around the world. Those are the things that we know are coming. That gets us down to 42 easily. Now, if the entire world goes the way of Korea and Iran and Italy, as opposed to Singapore and Hong Kong, and these things just go out of control and suddenly half of the world looks like Wuhan, China, we could easily get to $25 oil because just everything shuts down at that point. That would only occur with a super contango condition where you've got just the front month crashing as transportation just grinds to a halt because everybody's afraid to fly on an airplane. On the other hand, we could learn to contain this thing. We could figure out what went so well for Singapore and so badly for South Korea and figure out how to repeat that with all the other subsequent outbreaks that happen around the world. Maybe 42 will be the bottom. But I'll be very surprised, Patrick, if we don't get down to 42.36, a retest of the 2018 low. And then it's just a question of what happens in terms of the news flow to determine how much more downside might be possible after that.
Eric, how did the inventory numbers come in on oil?
Well, they didn't really affect the market too much because the coronavirus story and everything was bigger news. But crude oil building 452,000 barrels, that's a smaller build than was expected. Cushing, Oklahoma, though, building 906,000 barrels, almost a million barrels there in Cushing. Gasoline drawing down 2.7 million barrels, distillates drawing down 2.1 million barrels. It's also a refinery fire in California and a few other things going on in the physical market. But of course, the big economic story was the coronavirus that was affecting all markets. And again, it was really no surprises this week, just things that we knew were coming. U.S. production holding steady at 13 million barrels. That's unchanged from last week. It is an all-time record high set a couple months ago. Tape action, there was a little pop-up on a smaller-than-expected build, but of course it was all downhill after that as the virus news took over the tape from there.
All right, let's move on to gold bullion, because we almost traded to 1700 before it paused and gave a little bit of a pullback. Is there more upside in gold in your mind?
Well, Patrick, I have been inundated on Twitter and email with people saying, what the heck is going on? How come gold's not going up when it should be? I don't know why they're asking me that, because we explained it, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, right here on Macro Voices. What's going on is this coronavirus, anytime anything bad happens in the world, it should be good news for the gold market. But there's a few reasons that that's not happening right now. One is the old adage of buy the rumor, sell the news. When we knew that this coronavirus event was coming two or three weeks ago, gold was going up on speculation. Once the news hit the tape that it had happened, we came off a bit. And one of the most likely reasons for that is the same phenomenon that took gold sharply lower in 2008, even though it seems like, you know, everybody knew stimulus was coming, and we're much more able to know now that stimulus is definitely coming than we knew in 2008, you know, should be positive for gold. The answer is very simple. People have to sell their winners in order to cover the losses in their losers. A lot of people lost a lot of money in their stock positions this week, and they've got to sell their gold, unfortunately, in order to raise money, in order to cover their losses in other markets. It would actually, as far as I'm concerned, be a godsend to long-term gold bulls like myself if we had a repeat of that, if whatever market event happens with the coronavirus, if it forces gold to sell off a lot, like let's say back down to 1350, because everybody is selling everything in order to raise liquidity, that's a setup for a really fantastic buying opportunity, just like we had when gold bottomed in 2008 and then began its bull run all the way up to its all-time high in 2011. So I won't be at all surprised if, especially if the coronavirus situation gets worse from here, which I think is very, very possible, I wouldn't be surprised to see gold sell off more. And it's counterintuitive. Gold, it should be bullish for gold. But will people be forced to sell their gold just because they need to raise cash because they lost on other bets? That really is the driver for the downside, I think.
Let's move on to that 10-year treasury yield, because it's a pretty big deal. I mean, I think this is an all-time new low in 10-year yields. We traded under 1.25 on the yield. What's your take on all of this?
Well, last week, I predicted we would take out the 1.34 2016 all-time low on the 10-year treasury. And I got a couple of emails calling me names for suggesting such a stupid thing. Didn't I look silly for saying it could get as low as 1.34? Well, what are we, 10 basis points lower now? It ain't over yet, folks. I think it's very likely that this coronavirus crisis, even if it's only as bad as, you know, the better case, is going to take us to sub 1% yields on the U.S. 10-year treasury before this is over. But the question then, Patrick, is what happens if it's not the best case and it's one of the worst cases, in which case I think it could be a lot lower. We've already, as I said last week, I think I said, treasury yields are going lower. It's just hard to dare to jump in on the long side of the trade here because you're a little bit late to the party. Well, needless to say, 10 or 11 basis points ago last week, maybe it wasn't a bad time to jump in, despite being late at the party. I think there's still lower to come here. So we'll see how it plays out, but I think we're headed below 1%.
This week's featured interview guest is Fasanera Capital's founder, Francesco Filia. Why did we invite Francesco back as our guest this week?
Well, Patrick, it was inspired by the risk that we see in the market before the news broke. I felt that Francesco is a guy who really understands systemic risk and what some of the feedback loops are that can cause market events, when they're big events, to really go crazy. That's where a lot of his analysis has been focused. And I thought, since we know something big is on the horizon and coming, and this coronavirus thing, that's who we ought to interview. As it turned out, we interviewed him before the news broke this week. So you won't hear a lot of discussion about the coronavirus situation, simply because the interview was taped before the market really started to slide. But needless to say, it was motivated by expecting this. And so a lot of the topics that we're going to discuss have to do with systemic risk in the market. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In the past, the founder and host, Niels Kastrup Larsen, has provided Macro Voices listeners with some really good resources. But I think you'll agree with me that this time, he's really outdone himself with a brand new third edition to his Ultimate Guide to Systematic Trading Books. Now, this latest edition isn't limited to just quant trading books. It's actually a comprehensive guide to many of the best investing books ever written. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can get a free copy of this excellent guide to all the best investing books by going to toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Francesco is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Fasanara Capital founder Francesco Filia. And I always enjoy interviewing Francesco because not only does he always send us a terrific slide deck, but it's usually a big slide deck. So we won't be able to get to all of the slides in this deck. I do strongly encourage our listeners to peruse the entire deck because it has some really fantastic content in it. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't yet registered a free account at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Francesco's picture on our homepage. Francesco, we can't get into every single slide here, so I want to start maybe with page 6, I believe, where you're looking at the 50-year swap rate. Tell us what's going on here and fit it into the big picture of what you see in the markets.
Yes, thank you, Eric, and thank you for inviting me again. This slide is really like one to exemplify the dramatic and also comical situations that we find ourselves into in the markets. There is always like the attention being shifted to this or that trigger to a market downside, that this or that theme of the day, I guess in days like this is the coronavirus, the COVID-19. Prior to this, it was the assassination of the Iranian general. Before that, it was trade wars or the repo mess and this and that. But in reality, like the big elephant in the room is simpler than that. And it is really the dramatic situations that bonds are into, where we live through negative interest rates, and for that much bonds around the globe. And this is not even making the headlines any longer. It is a fact of life. It is considered just part of the furniture. It is not raising eyebrows. But you have like bonds even on long-dated maturities. And here we exemplify, for example, the 50-year swap rate, which is representing swaps in Europe, right, for the whole curve, that dipped into negative territory last summer. And now again is very close to zero. It's probably going to go below zero again. And our point with this is really that bonds, when they yield negatively, are no longer bonds. We should find a different name for it. Probably it's to be called fake cash or quasi-bond or anti-bond or something like this. We need to find a name for it, but it's definitely not a bond. And the point that we make here is that this is the elephant in the room. It is driving valuations all across asset classes. There is the law of communicating vessels, which is at play, and which means that if you retire one entire asset class from the market, the nearby asset classes will need to benefit from it for various reasons, but really mechanical reasons, which is also what is being theorized by central bankers when doing these dramatic negative rates in the form of portfolio balance channel theory or in the form of a trickle-down effect into other asset classes and eventually into the real economy, which clearly failed, right? Because we haven't seen all of those positive implications in the real economy. And these are not bonds anymore. It means that really that when we look at balanced portfolios out there, which is the majority of asset allocation globally, and we look at the 60-40, 40-60, whatever, really we look at the portion of bonds which is not there anymore. I mean, we think it is there, but it is not there. It is a figment of imagination. That bond is not there, which means really that the portfolio at that point is a long only equity. And next to the equity, there is a fake cash or something that used to be a bond that in reality not only is cash because it's not yielding any money, but also can bite back and can create some damage at some point down the road because it's also a very long extension in maturity and therefore a price risk and a duration risk. So this is just, you know, to see that the big elephant in the room is negative rates. It's affecting in the next slide that you see a bond of Nokia on page number 7. Nokia is a beautiful company, nothing to say about it, except that it's sub-investment grade. But even if it's a beautiful company, it should probably not trade at 11 basis points over. And it was trading negatively at some point during the summer of last year. And probably it's going to go back to negative territory. It's a short-dated bond. Yes, I take that. But still, there should be no reason in the world why this bond trades what it's trading. And the abnormality of the situations that doesn't stop there. On the next slide, slide 8, we have the reminder of the situation, the comical situation of the Austrian bond, 100 years in duration, that rallied by something like 80% in a matter of a few months. I mean, it's worth reminding of it, because obviously we all know about it. It made the headlines when it first happened, but now it's forgotten. And, you know, here is a market where a bond, which is a govy, can trade up in price as big as Tesla, and it gets forgotten. And it is a market where, like, the investor community is looking at bonds for capital gain and equities for income. So the laws of finance have been completely flipped through. I think that on negative rates, a lot can be said. One of the points that we make is that there is a nocebo effect to negative interest rates. Nocebo is the opposite of placebo. Placebo is that terminology utilized in the medicine where there is a substance that has no real impact on one's health, but still gets to be positive because of the psychological effect that has got on the person that believes it to be positive. And in the same way, we think that there is a nocebo effect on negative rates. When investors are faced with negative rates, they have all sort of negative implication when looking at future expected returns, which are considered to be lower, and therefore there is less of a need for capital expenditure and for like investment, productive investments. And you see these into savers, which save less, consumers, which consume more, all sorts of negative implications. And this is really psychological. In addition to that, there is obviously the also negative implications from the mechanical standpoint that, for example, like European banks have had to pay $25 billion to the ECB because of negative rates, and that has obviously weighed on their profitability. But it's really the nocebo effect that we think is much more powerful and is highly underestimated by policymakers these days.
Francesco, it's fascinating to me because I hear from so many of the smartest people we talk to about this same issue, which is bonds are not really bonds anymore. Jeff Snyder told us, you know, you have to recognize that the old idea of a treasury bond as an investment, it's really not a viable investment. It returns a negative real interest rate. There's no sensible reason to invest in it. It has become a tool of large financial institution balance sheet management that really no longer makes sense. I spoke to Ralph Del Judas about this same subject last week, and he echoed Jeff's comments and had a lot more to say about it. So I want to go a little deeper on what you just said. I get it. I understand that bonds are not bonds anymore, but what are the systemic implications of what used to be considered the safest investment on earth, and furthermore, the core investment for a lot of pension funds and other major institutions, was always the U.S. Treasury bond. Cue the patriotic American music. You've got the full faith and backing of the U.S. government. It's the best investment on earth. You and Jeff Snyder and Ralph Del Judas all seem to agree it's not even an investment anymore. What are the implications of that?
Well, the first one, let me start with the systems theory. Like we try to look at markets as complex dynamic systems. So not the single parts in isolation, but the system as a whole. And I think that obviously when you speak about systemic risk, you should think about the systems first, right? And like the first effect that you have having retired bonds, having rendered them the equivalent of tax bills, is the following, is that you have lost the buffers in the system against risk and negative impacts. You have lost the ability to absorb shocks. When the system is subject to a stressor, it is unable to go back to the initial position because they've lost the buffer. And the buffer of bonds is very well known, right? We know from the past crisis, 1929, 2000, 2008, 1987 even. We know that whenever equity markets were in free fall, bonds could save the day to a balanced portfolio. So they could rally bonds and yields moving lower, and therefore kind of softening the losses on the equity part. This today is impossible because the rates are already very low. And I remember when we did this podcast last year that the rates were higher than they are today, but still they could fall. And indeed they fell as the market showed some weakness here and there. But now you have like the long dated treasuries yielding below 2%. So yes, they can still fall further. They can go down to zero or even negative territory, but most of it is done. Most of it is behind us. So that buffer, which is a cushion against the risk, is lost. And that is a big deal for balanced portfolios around the world. It means that during the next big equity downfall, you have bonds that are unable to rally. It means that the losses in the financial markets are going to be way larger. If the losses in the financial markets are going to be way larger, it means also that the implications for the real economy are potentially much bigger. And the second effect that it has got, and here I go into more the psychological effect, is the fact that this market has become a nihilist, right? Meaning that there is no morality attached to the market any longer because people have got used to ignore completely valuations. And this starts again with bonds. I mean, there are a lot of examples in this presentation about equity nonsense, right? You know, like, you know, there is the one of Moody's that is trading like a tech company. There is the peak-peg ratio. Here is the slide 10 that is like effectively comparing the valuations on the S&P to their potential growth, which is also out of whack. But I would say that on bonds, just to keep it general, you know, the market is nihilist because they've lost the morality. And what is the morality to financial markets? The morality to financial markets is valuation, right? And we all agree in the market that these days valuations are not the main driver of performance. Momentum is. It's a one big momentum trade. But not being driven by valuation does not mean that valuations are completely to be ignored and are completely to be ridiculized. And these days, to have a bond like this, it's a completely, you know, a completely ridiculous proposition. And it's funny that so many market participants try to find some rationale in where bonds are trading by calling into effect demographics or inflation expectations or any other type of technological improvement and therefore pressure down on prices. I mean, these are all nice arguments, but none of them is really able to justify why a bond should be a tax bill, why a bond should be trading negatively and not zero or slightly positive. So I think that this is a big monstrosity and it's creating the type of market that we are facing, especially when coupled with the quantitative easing, when coupled with the talks of MMT and forward guidance for more monetary injections. And then no wonder that you have this big wave up in prices, totally decorrelated from valuations.
Francesco, there's another common theme that really rings true for me in your slide deck as I talk to some of the other smartest people that we have on the program. They've all told me in different ways, look, don't just dismiss the blow-ups we've had in the repo market. The daily liquidity situation that is getting critical in financial markets, it's not just an anomaly. It's not just a month-end effect. There's something significant that warrants paying close attention to. So it came as no surprise to me when I see page 14 in your deck. You've got a title here that says the risk of a $2 trillion margin call. And then the heading above it is the upcoming daily liquidity crisis. What are you talking about and how does that play into the whole story of what's going on in the marketplace?
Well, basically, like we have lived in an environment where the market has been trained to believe that a downfall in prices of 2 to 5% is enough to trigger a buy the dip opportunity, right? This has been the recent years, especially in the US markets. And this has generated all sorts of market behavior. Now, the other thing that we have seen in the last 10 years is the rise of the machines and the passive investment strategies, right? So there are a lot of vehicles out there which are in autopilot, different degrees of autopilot, but still an autopilot. And it goes not only to the CTAs or to the quant funds. It also affects the risk parity, the risk premia, the low volatility vehicles, and obviously the totally passive, the ETFs and the likes. So the passive vehicles have been also a consequence of the fact that as yields go close to zero, there is even more of a pressure to compress fees on fund managers. And what better there is to compress fees if not to go totally passive? With totally passive, the fees can be asymptotically close to zero. Then there is another element to this, which is ETFs have given direct market access to retail. Retail in the past used to be intermediated by either financial advisors or by fund managers. Today, retail has got one direct access to the market, and all of the new technologies affecting the asset managers are there to eliminate the intermediary. So The other element to this, and let me conclude there, is the daily liquidity. So there is an obsession by the investor community for daily liquidity vehicles. They are called differently in different geographical areas. So in the US, you have the 40 Act, and then you have also the ETFs, obviously. In Europe, you have all the UCITS fund, which are really the bulk of the asset under management for the industry. So take into account these three elements. Passively managed, which means autopilots, and passive aggressive. If the market goes down, they go down with the market. So they will sell as the market goes down. Retail driven, which means weak hands, because the retail will be the first to lose in a panic mode when there is a downfall in prices. And the third element is daily liquidity, which means hot money. This means that if the investors wants out, there is no gate in front of it. It can just simply sell. And this money is due the next day, right? So the toxic combination of these three elements is what really makes the market structure dangerous these days. There could be a situation, and it almost close to happened in December of 2018, where the stock market loses 10 to 20% in one single month. That provokes headlines and panic selling on the side of retail investors and those investors at large. And that could equate into a very big margin call, a very big redemption event, where on a day-to-day basis, you could have 2 to 4 trillion being sold in the market in a very short fashion. It's a snowball effect at that point. And my point is that if that takes place, and it may have been almost taking place down in December, and that's why central banks panicked, if that takes place, there will be no way for the Fed, for the ECB, for the Bank of Japan, for the Bank of England, together to intervene and prevent that from creating havoc in the markets. That would be too big for anybody to manage. How do we get to this 2 to 4 trillion? I mean, it's a very simple math. I mean, it's no rocket science. If you take just the three top asset managers globally, Vanguard, State Street, and BlackRock, you're looking at something like 17.2 trillion in asset under management, last time I checked. It's a monumental a big amount of asset under management. If you consider like a market downfall of 20% on any given month, and then you consider investors redeeming after such a panic situation in the market, you can easily see that they may redeem 10 to 20% of their holdings in the market. They may just try to liquidate that. And here you go, you are already at 2 to 4 trillion, just considering the top three asset managers alone. This also brings us to another point, which is the fact that asset managers have never been considered strategically important financial institution, whereas they are these days because of this structure of the market, because of the size that they got themselves into and the systemic implications of their role in such markets. And let me also say that there is a parallel to this, to the previous crisis, which is 2007-2008. At the time, it was a leverage problem. We had the banks like Lehman, which were levered up 40 times. And at the time, the problem was a margin call. The margin call meant that all of a sudden the money could be asked from Lehman or from banks like that, and Lehman would have to pay them back the next day or in a very short fashion. With that much leverage, the risk was an overcompensation to the downside. As the collateral value shrank because of falling prices, the lender would ask the money back from Lehman, and Lehman would have had to liquidate positions on the back end. Now, that risk is not as big as it used to be back then, and surely it's not as big for the banking sector. But guess what? The risk is as big as then or much higher in the asset management industry. And it does not come through leverage. It comes through notional. So we have this very sophisticated concept that we had developed here at Fasanara, which is a notional after leverage. So to not be fooled by the leverage itself being as not as big as then, but just look at the notional. And the notional for the asset management industry, as I said before, can be looked at as that 17 trillion on three managers alone. I think that is the real, the time bomb that is sitting in the market. And whenever we look at new triggers in the market, we should always ask ourselves, what's behind the corner? Are we really going to face this 2 to 4 trillion margin call? And if we do, what happens? And I think that me and you, we don't know really for sure whether this is going to happen and with what time frame. And we don't know if we should be panicking for this or not. But I think that there is somebody in the market out there that really knows this a little bit better, and that is the central banks themselves. And if I read through their behavior over the last few years, I can see that they really panic when the market is going down. We have seen this in December 2018. Where the Federal Reserve served the flipped in a dramatic U-turn, moving from QT, quantitative tightening all the way to quantitative easing, and even talks of MMT. At the time, we called that jumping the shark, because it was really not necessary, but they did. And admittedly, they must have been really scared about what was going on in the market. And they moved also into rate cuts. We saw it again in September of 2019, where there was the repo mess associated to clearing houses, most likely. And they panicked back then as well. And they embarked into a big balance sheet expansion. $500 trillion got printed out. It's really similar to QE. At the beginning, it was only repo. Then it became T-bills, which is the very definition of QE. And guess what? The last time around this happened was in at the turn of the century, in Y2K. And even back then, there was a big bubble forming, which was then followed by a big overcompensation to the downside and a big bust. So we can see that we can read the panic of the central banks as a proof of that of the fragility of the system. And I would look at them as smoking guns.
Francesco, something that has always appealed to me about your work and your perspective on markets from our previous interviews is your focus on markets as complex systems with a lot of interdependencies and complex feedback loops. It's not simple. There's a lot of interdependency in how markets actually function as complex systems. And I know we've talked about that in past interviews, but I don't remember really any objective tools for managing or controlling or coping with risk in these complex systems. If I look ahead to page 24 in the slide deck, it looks like perhaps you're introducing some new tools to do exactly that. Am I right? And if so, tell us all about them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are alone in this endeavor because we don't think or we don't know about many people trying to do this because it's believed to be impossible. Right, it is believed to be impossible for somebody to estimate the probability of a crash in market terms. Or when you look at natural systems, natural ecosystems, it is believed to be impossible to really predict with certainty or with a very high degree of probability when there is the next earthquake or the next epileptic seizure in the brain and so on and so forth. But guess what? In the physical world, you know, ecologists and scientists are indeed spending a lot of time in tools associated with complexity theory and with the systems theory. And there is a body of research that is attempting to do just that. In the market, you find nobody, you know, trying to do that. So we try to fill the gap in a way, right? In the market, you find that the same conventional, traditional market analysis that you found 20, 30 years ago, which looks at triggers all the time. It looks at this trigger being the trade wars or that trigger, and if there is no trigger, nothing will happen. Whereas systems theory tells you that you don't need a trigger necessarily. It's the systems that transition at some point after you reach a critical threshold. And we try to estimate in various shapes and forms, what is that critical threshold? What is the proximity to that market cliff? And there are a number of tools which are offered to us by complexity theory. They are not perfect tools, obviously. When you say you estimate the timing, it doesn't mean this week or this month. It doesn't even mean this year. But it can shed some light on the current market events, and it can help you navigate in a bit better way than the traditional market analysis. Let me tell that the traditional market analysis looks, if you wanted to have a sensor to chaos, has been used to look at the VIX or the volatility, the implied volatility. And that's been used as in various shapes and forms, like the value at risk, for example. And that is that has been an element that has been utilized to determine the certain leverage in the portfolio, a certain risk exposure, a certain position sizing. But guess what? When it comes to systemic risk, volatility is actually groundwork, is a necessary condition to systemic risk, because it's exactly after a prolonged period of low volatility that you end up into trouble. And this has been proven time and time again over the course of modern financial history. It's when volatility is low that complacency grows and the banks, they start to overextend themselves into lending and into credit and into leverage. And that's when the problems arise. So VIX cannot help. Volatility cannot help. Value at risk cannot help. So what we tried here is to procure some different tools based on complexity and not based on volatility. And the tools that we have been trying to produce are these following tools. So like we have one to visualize the tensions in the market structure. So it's like taking a picture of the market at each point in time from the viewpoint of the structure. And to us, it's a little bit like taking a picture of the assassin on the crime scene, right? You know, there are certain faces of the market during bad and good times, which can be taken a picture of. And for example, if you go to page 25 of the presentation, you will see that the market during Lehman, if you take this picture is based on agent-based modeling and pairwise correlations and a few other things, and it's focusing on the largest ETFs. You can see that the face of the market during Lehman is much different than the face during a normal market condition like September 10. And then you see again that the face of the market right now, in recent times, really looks very similar to the one of Lehman and not to the one of a healthy market condition. So on this market deck, there will be also a link that projects you into a page on our portal where you can see these visualizations tool on the market at any given point in time on a weekly basis. So this is number one. This is what we try to see. Where do we stand in terms of market structure? Then there is a tool that helps you to monitor the impact of a market epidemic. We update our simulations and they say basically how damaging can be a certain market structure. And this is slide number 28. And here we can see that for a certain market event, you could have a downfall on the S&P as big as 60%. And this, by the way, is no big surprise. These days, the S&P is so expensive that if it goes down 30%, it will go back to a price where it will go to a position where it's still extremely expensive. And so it means that we put ourselves really in the corner of the market because not even a 20 to 30% reprise will mean that you make it fairly valued. So this is no surprise, this analysis. Then you have a tool to estimate the proximity to a large-scale systemic risk event. This is what we call the SRI, is a systemic resilience indicator. You can find it on page 29. It's a long wave tool. It doesn't help you to determine what will happen tomorrow, obviously, but it tells you that this market setting is already way more dangerous, way more expensive than Lehman time, and also than the turn of the century during the tech bubble. It's the pink line, and it shows that that we are really into a dangerous zone where if there is a critical transition, it can be no surprise. It is measured in mathematical quantities. This sensor is based on the Ricci curvature. Now, I will not go into the theory of it, but I will just say that the Ricci curvature is a similar quantity, mathematical quantity to entropy, where the difference is that the entropy looks at the narrow nodes, the closed nodes in a system, whereas the Ricci curvature looks at the distant nodes. And we think it's more relevant for the market structure. Then we did all of this already a year or so ago, and we decided to add to the toolkit some short-dated, small-scale indicators. Because it's always good to say something about the next cycle and the big wave, but what about the next 15 days or even the next 5 days? So we tried utilizing complexity, again, not volatility, to determine the probability of a small-scale market event on a short horizon of 5 to 15 days. And this is what can be found on pages 30 and 31. The latest one that we are yet to publish is page 31. And this measures the probability of a downfall of 2 to 5% in the next 5 days. It is based on earthquake technology, earthquake mathematics. And we can see that the accuracy of this indicator, according to our analysis, has been above 65%. So it was actually very good. When we compare it with the more traditional indicators like the VIX and like volatility, it was actually a superior indicator. So we are very flattered by that, by those results. On page 30, you see another one, which is based again on early warning signals coming from system theory. And again, it estimates the probability of seeing a market fall in the following 15 days. Put them all together, and you are on page 32. And this, to us, is the cockpit to systemic risk. So it's the combination of all of those systemic risk alerts in one place. And this is what we look to determine whether or not it's time to go, it's time to position, it's time to capture the moment of discontinuity. And here you have all them together, the 5 days, the 15 days, the Ricci curvature, which is the long wave, and the market structure, so which is this continuous peak of the market structure to know whether or not we are in a dangerous situation. And this, again, Eric, it doesn't give any certainty, obviously, but it is like, I think that despite the fact that it's difficult, we should all try to attempt to create something new in the asset management industry when it comes to keeping ourselves with tools that can help us estimate the state of the art on systemic resilience and systemic fragility in the market.
Well, Francesco, it's so tempting. You've got such a smorgasbord of fantastic slides and graphs in this deck. I want to just spend 3 hours asking you all about it. But I know what our listeners are going to appreciate most is if we focus on how to translate all of these high-level concepts into actionable trading ideas. So what can you tell us about what you conclude and where this all takes you in terms of what to do in today's market?
Well, I would go to slide 18. In slide 18, we summarize what we think is the options to our rational investors, assuming that there is still a rational investor out there, right? Because most people are making too much money to care. And that is also part of the systemic risk argument, that there are a lot of perverse incentives baked in the cake, making the crisis also much more likely. We think that one option is obviously the simplest of all, which is to go into cash, gold, and wait it out. I think this is a fair possibility for investors to decide to do. They've made good money in the bull run, and it may be time to take money home and just wait for better times to invest, where their return expectations are better than they are today. And at that point, a combination of gold, cash, and patience can be the best one. If you want to do something about it, if you want still to be involved into markets, our personal recipe for how to tackle the current market structure is the following one. Four options. One is a tail risk. You know, like you just go for it. You try to capture the moment of the adjustment. In itself, it's a great opportunity. We called it a generational opportunity. As I said, that the S&P down 30% doesn't cut it. You know, here we are talking about something much more dramatic. I would say an S&P below 2000, if anything. But even if it's not down there, it's still going to be really a big event, in my personal opinion. And the way to position for this is like a tail risk strategy, right? Involving like a bunch of different things, some of which having to do with, ways of edging the portfolio. But it is really, as far as we are concerned, it is really a very, a high octane proposition where you are prepared to lose 10 to 20% a year, but you can make 500% if the time comes and the adjustment comes. I don't think you can do this by having a positive carry. So I don't believe it is possible these days in the market to still get a positive performance and at the same time be ready for the moment of adjustment. I am a strong believer of the fact that if you are not losing money, you are probably not ready to capture the moment for when the moment comes. The second option is a quant strategies. In our own trading, we apply quantitative techniques to trading, and we guide those quantitative techniques with the complexity-based indicators. Again, not volatility-driven, but complexity-based. Complexity means linked to the structure of the market, looking at things like what are the tensions in the system, and when those tensions arise, the indicators, they tell us to go quickly into cash, possibly also into shorts. And this is another thing, the indicators that we discussed before are all usable, let's say, to this purpose. The other one, which I think is actionable, is what we call alternative credit, which means in the public markets, it's very difficult to make a living these days. You can either go with the flow and follow the momentum and still make your assets grow, but you're probably not doing the most sensible thing because you are picking dimes in front of a steamroller. There is a big event in front of you. You don't know when, but there is. And therefore, it's probably not a very, an honest proposition. And we think that public markets are really unattractive these days in both public equities and public bonds. If you go to the most classical private debt strategies, you also don't find a great appeal because there is a bubble there as well. You are literally surrounded by bubbles everywhere. But there is a way that you can do, which is to go to the real economy and try to find anti-bubbles or places that are not expensive as yet. And what do I mean? The market of the mid-caps, the small and medium enterprises are still financing themselves at very high rates, 5 to 10%, if not higher, whenever they can find the funding. Sometimes they don't even are able to find the funding. And I think that the bubble is on the large corporates, because the large corporates are such as Nokia, that we have seen before, are trading at zero, literally zero. But the SMEs are still paying top dollars for their funding. And definitely, there is more risk associated to SMEs. But if I can compare an SME paying 10% to a large corporate paying zero, I would argue that the bubble is on the large corporates and is not on the SME. And when you are paid zero on a bond investment or on a financing, you really have no buffer against any type of credit risk. You know, so little needs to happen for you to lose money. When you are invested into SMEs at a 10% yield, you have a big buffer. And then you ask yourself, what was the default rate of SMEs during the Lehman crisis? And the answer is, it was 4% in continental Europe, for example, 4 to 5%. It was actually not staggeringly high. And this means that you have a big buffer, which may insure you for something which is even bigger than what happened during Lehman. And this, to me, is a resilient investment, a resilient place for money. Now, to trade with SMEs is not the same as with large corporates. It requires a totally different approach. You need a proper infrastructure, a proper technology, boots on the ground, a lot more people. You know, it's a much more cumbersome proposition. But I think that these current markets are pushing ourselves into looking at the next trade in a bit more of an inventive way, and going outside of the box and trying to really find things to justify also management fees and performance fees.
Francesco, final question. I know that a lot of your research, and I guess we haven't talked about it in this interview, so maybe you could elaborate first, but a lot of your research that we've discussed before describes reasons that the market has changed in a way that very rapid reactions and changes, you know, more the flash crash as opposed to the five-year long bear market. I want you to first address why your research reveals that that kind of move is more likely in the market structure that we have. But particularly, and this is just my own view, I really think that the biggest and most mispriced risk in decades is this coronavirus situation. I think that it has the potential of causing much more economic damage than almost anyone is anticipating. If it turns out that I'm correct, that coronavirus is bigger than most market participants have estimated, what could it mean in terms of how the structure of the market might result in perhaps a very rapid event as opposed to a slow event in terms of financial market reaction?
I believe that a flash crash, so a crash where the speed of adjustment is really very high, is a definite possibility. I also believe that sometimes it's the only possibility, because the opposite to that or the alternative to that would be a slow-moving downfall in prices. I don't see that happening, also because the central banks would intervene again. And so also by definition, like it cannot happen that easily. Whereas I think that a flash crash, if it happens in the fashion in which I described before, where there is a huge margin call of 2 to 4 trillion, will be too big for them to tackle. So in a way, it's a way for the market system to bypass the line of defense of the central banks. In my mentality, my idea, my theory, you know, it's the only way for the system to adjust and let go of potential energy. It is exactly because of all these ring fencing that the central banks have tried to give to the markets, to these broken markets, to these fake markets, to these pampered markets, that will make it more likely for the system to adjust in a very dramatic and fast fashion. And coming to the coronavirus, or the COVID-19, I think that, look, the market interpretation of it is very clear. Right, so the market thinks that is, you know, at least at the beginning, the market interpreted that as a little bit like what happened in the U.S. during the freezing cold weather in 2016, I believe it was, where there was a lost quarter of GDP followed by a very strong pent-up demand. And following that, also, the expectation of a millennials-type market, which is for central banks to intervene to an adversity with even more monetary printing. So the market looks at this and says, yes, but China is a very proud nation. They're going to print left, right, and center in order to fill the gap created by the coronavirus. So that is the interpretation of the market. Now, if they are right or wrong in this specific instance, I don't know. I can definitely agree with you that the potential implications are huge because they work on an already fragile market structure. And what I can say about the coronavirus is that if a market event like this assassination of the Iranian general back in early January was leading to a potential also risky situations on the geopolitical front, but you could never be sure about it. In the case of the coronavirus, in addition to the dramatic situations of the pandemic, which is not dramatic now, but it could become, you have the real implication in the real economy, because if we block a certain economic areas, like some parts of China, more recently also the northern part of Italy, and so on and so forth, you create an economic impact already tangible, even before you discover whether or not the pandemic reaches a certain alarming state. So, and in particular, in the Chinese case, you block the supply chain, and there are some corporates which may not be able to recover from it. So it's definitely a very serious situation and could definitely be one such element that that provides the trigger. I don't think a trigger is needed, but definitely this could be one that accelerates the adjustment in the markets.
Francesco, I want to close by just emphasizing to our listeners, because we have a lot of people who listen while driving and they can't download the slide deck. Folks, we've barely even scratched the surface of how much content exists in this slide deck. So once your drive is done, I really do encourage you to download the deck. There's a lot more here than what we've had time to discuss today. Beyond the slide deck, Francesco, for people who want to follow your work or learn more about what you do at Fasanara Capital, please tell them how they can contact you and follow your work.
Our website is probably the right place. It's www.fasanara.com. You won't find much information about our investment vehicles there. We tend to avoid doing that. We don't like speaking about specific fund products. We keep it very generic and very theoretical in a way. I think we shared in this presentation more than we are accustomed to in a way, you know, hinting to some of our strategies. But definitely the point of contact could be the website. We publish research on various market topics. Our attention in the recent past has been on systemic risk because we think nobody else is caring about it or not too much. And therefore, we've been focusing on that. And we encourage everybody listening that wants to contribute to our research to please offer to do so, because we believe in the open ecosystem in terms also of our work activities. And we like to tie up to people that they have something to say and something to contribute.
Well, Francesco, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was so great to have Francesco back on the show. And it's funny because going back to 2018 in January, we had both Chris Cole and Francesco on the show just prior to the Volmageddon event. And it's interesting that we have the same lineup of guests right before this market event. Nonetheless, it was really interesting to see him talking about the complexity-based system risks. Whether you take a George Soros reflexivity or something, it's really important to understand how dynamic the market is. And it's really interesting to get his take on all of that.
Well, I guess we have a new market indicator that is proven now to be 100% effective, which is when we have both Chris Cole and Francesco Filia scheduled in the same month, it means there's going to be a big vol event in the market. I'm glad to put that into my playbook. Let's move on, though, because our listeners gave us terrific feedback. Last week, you did part one of long volatility trades using options, and we intentionally started last week by not getting into tail hedges, but just focusing on volatility itself, how to buy volatility using the options market. This week, I know our listeners want to learn about the tail hedge aspect of it. Patrick, you put together a post-game chart book, which our listeners can find in the Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not registered. Shame on you. Just go to macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Francesco's picture. Patrick, let's talk about this chart book. I see you don't have Kevin Muir in his market huddle menswear on the first page. I would recommend adding that since he lost a bet with you recently. But let's go ahead and dive into the rest of the chart book.
Well, for sure. And so it's actually amazing that the market had this event right in between the two presentations, because the one thing we were really emphasizing last week was that when you go long volatility, it's great for that one rainy day event, but it's not necessarily the great strategy for a rainy decade, the way Chris Cole put it. The whole point is anyone who went long volatility, whether you did a strategy to go long Vega or you went long the VIX in any way, you got a pretty good payoff with the volatility having spiked now up to the 30%+ range. But really at this moment, you got this big payoff for this big spike. But being long volatility at these like 30%+ vol levels is not asymmetric anymore. And you can now just as easily get hurt as you can continue to make more money. And so the idea behind being long volatility for this kind of bigger portfolio hedge is this idea of going long tail risk, which is when the market makes these extraordinary moves out of these tight ranges, that you're making money on the wings, both on the up and the downside of these big market moves. And so the question is, how can you do this with a very little or small carry cost? And that's really the interesting part that we want to dive into this. And so what it really comes down to, in order to be long tail risk, you need an option strategy that is long gamma on the wings. It's this idea where the option will really start to behave like a full-on equity position when one of those wings is reached on the markets. And so what I wanted to do on page three is just start off by explaining delta and gamma, terms that many of our listeners may have heard us use before, but just it's important to kind of give a framework for understanding the theory behind it. So it's important before we talk gamma to understand delta. And so delta is the Greek that measures the rate of change of the price of the option, the rate of change of the option itself, relative to the change of the underlying price. So the easiest way to think about it, Eric, is if, let's say, a stock rises from, let's say, $10 to $11, and the option that you own increased by 50 cents, then you can more or less assume, if all other variables were constant, that the delta was 50 cents. Right, which is that it's about the sensitivity of the option for a change in the underlying price. But gamma, on the other hand, is the second derivative of that. Gamma measures the rate of change of the delta itself. And so this is where I think that the easiest way to think about it is on page four, by explaining it by showing this chart, which is what we have is the slope of a call option there. And an option's journey is whether it's journey down to a delta zero or up to a delta one. And where it is on the slope of this curve is the delta of the option. And what the gamma is the rate of which this slope is steepening or flattening. And so this is an example of how we want to look at gamma from that chart.
Okay, Patrick, I got the concepts. Gamma is the second derivative, the rate of change of delta. Got the Greek concepts down, but okay, wait a minute. How do I turn this into a strategy that achieves the kind of portfolio goals that Chris Cole was talking about?
Right. And so this is where I just need one last major point to be very clear to our listeners. And then we'll talk about the idea of putting this into a strategy. The whole point that you can see on page five is that when you're long gamma, when you're long options, whether you're long a call or you're long a put, you're long gamma or have a positive gamma. And the problem with buying a call or buying a put is it costs money. And it suffers from theta or time decay. And so when you hear the term that it has a negative carry is the fact that when you put on these options, they're time decaying while you own them, right? And so the question or the key way of trying to find how to put a strategy together is how can you build a strategy that doesn't have that huge negative carry, or at least changes the composition of where the negative outcome of the trade is negative. And so this is where I want to kind of talk about the only way you can really offset the fact that you're suffering time decay and it costs you money to carry this is to somehow combine short options with long options in order to create an offset for that negative carry. And so on page six, what we have is just a traditional long put chart graph. And what this is just showing is the fact that, well, when you spend money to buy a put to, let's say, insure a portfolio, and you want to buy some tail risk to insure the downside risk of that zone below the red line is the zone where you have that negative carry, which is essentially that no matter how high the stock goes, the cost of the option is a loss, and that loss is reducing your performance. And so how do you create a chart or some sort of a strategy that doesn't have that negative carry, that where even you're able to have that tail risk insurance, this idea that if, let's say, the market was to crash, that you're going to be able to cash in. But at the same time, if the market just keeps muddling along, it doesn't cost you a whole bunch of money to have these put options.
Okay, so if I want to buy insurance, I have to pay an insurance premium for that insurance. The way to offset that is to sell somebody else insurance, and the trick to it is to sell somebody insurance that's insurance that doesn't cost me very much to sell them, because what I'm insuring them against is something I'm not too worried about losing. Is that the gist of it?
Sort of. I mean, definitely you're trying to create the offset. Now, we've had numerous conversations in past shows. You even had the conversation with Tian Yang from Variant Perception, and then we talked about the strategy in many post games about using the ratio call spread, which is the way you would buy right tail insurance or the participation on a big right tail move in the stock market. But for this example, I wanted to just illustrate a left tail ratioed put spread, because that's one we haven't talked about. Now, the key here is that I just calculated theoretical prices based on a constant volatility. And so what we have is a $100 stock. And what we do here is we sell short the at-the-money $100 strike put. And so for selling a put, before we buy any options would be considered naked, you receive a $2.85 credit in this theoretical example. And so when we receive $285 income, we proceed to go out of the money. Let's say in this example, we're using the $95 put strike, and we buy twice as many puts down at the $95 strike. Those $95 strike puts, so remember, we're short the 100. Here, we're going to buy twice as many 95s. Those were trading 97 cents in, when at least from the numbers we put into the simulator. And therefore, it costs us $1.94 or $194 to buy these two puts. But because we received the credit, we are actually still left with a 91-cent credit after buying those two puts. What this creates is a scenario that, as so long as the market continues to stay flat or continues to rise, we are actually ahead of the game with a credit. We're actually earning an income. And often you can build these at zero cost, even if it has a small debit. The point is that if the market is rallying, it's costing you nothing to have this ratio put spread open. So where's the risk? That sounds almost too good to be true, right? Well, the risk is that one scenario where the market goes down a little and it is going against you a bit. And there you have a situation, as you can see on this chart, where the risk, the greatest risk in this ratio put spread is at $95. But there's that old adage, Eric, which is that the markets rise on an escalator but drop on an elevator. Rarely do we see scenarios where the market goes down just a little bit. And when one of these market corrections kicks in, it usually is a very violent drop, as we saw over the last 5 days, which is it blows right through that risk point and then catches that left tail, which is that you start making a pile of money when it drops below 90 in this example. And so what you're trying to do is create a scenario where a month after month or a year after year, while the markets are behaving, it's costing you very little to carry this hedge. But then when the market finally has an event, then you have something that builds huge intrinsic value when the market really starts to go against you. And so the ratio spread is one of the ways that you could do this with a very little carry.
So the graph on page 7 illustrates this visually, but going back to my insurance analogy, what you're really saying here is you want to buy insurance. If the market crashes, you want to get paid off big time with a great big insurance settlement. Problem is, you'd have to pay a premium for that insurance. So what you do is you sell somebody else insurance against the market going down just a little bit, because you know that's not a very likely scenario. But that actually pays pretty well. So you end up collecting the premium that someone else is paying you for insurance on something you don't think is going to happen, and you end up paying for your own insurance policy and still having cash left over, which you pocket as a profit unless the market goes down just a little bit. Speaking of which, Patrick, I got more than just a little bit of email last week when I mentioned in passing that maybe you should put on one of your famous boot camps, this time on trading volatility, taking this beyond the level of what we're able to do here in the postgame segments on Macro Voices. I know from my email inbox, there's a lot of interest. So what's going on? You got a plan now?
Yeah, so far we've been talking about this long vol and these tail risk hedging strategies in these theoretical scenarios. But however, in the live markets, it's far more dynamic with things like the vol skew influencing the option pricing. For instance, there's often a very fat left tail, which changes the way you can put this trade on. So understanding the vol surface of an options market is so important. And so it's important for me to be able to demonstrate to my members anyway, the impact and how to manage trades in these environments. So I'll be demonstrating these volatility strategies real time in the live markets, and I'll be doing that in that live volatility bootcamp. So we scheduled it for Friday, March 6th at 10 a.m. for Big Picture Trading members.
Okay, so for anyone who wants to watch you put on these long vol trades in a live session where they can actually watch you put the trades on in your online broker screen, that's 10 a.m. Eastern time on March 6th. And that, of course, is for Big Picture Trading members only, but you can get a free trial membership to Big Picture Trading. Patrick, in addition to this bootcamp, what else can people expect from Big Picture Trading membership?
So Eric, the membership allows you to basically trade along with me. All Big Picture Trading members receive access to all my analytics and trades, most of which I do in daily live webinars where members can interact and trade along with me as I put on these trades and help members manage that risk.
Okay, and that is for paid members, so that's not for free.
Right. There is a 14-day trial offer, which is still open and anyone can get access to. But to attend that live vol trading bootcamp, it's only for our paying members. And that membership is $99 a month. That includes not only that upcoming volatility live bootcamp, but it also includes some of the other strategies we covered in theory on Macro Voices, such as those ratio call spreads and the calendared straddles, which again, we just used to catch another market top. And so all of these boot camps and other tutorials are all available in the membership. More detailed information on Big Picture Trading membership can be found in that chart book.
Okay, fantastic. So how do people sign up?
They can sign up by just clicking on that sign up button on the last page of the chart book, or you can also find the link in the Research Roundup email, or you can visit the bigpicturetrading.com website or email us.
This episode was made possible by toptradersunplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find a transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book for Francesco's presentation, as well as the charts we just discussed here in the post game. There's an article from Jeff Snyder, That's the Thing About Things, and the video link to Centelli Exchange talking about the negative feedback loop. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, Follow our main Twitter account, at Macro Voices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, at Eric S. Townsend, and myself, at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.